Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the frustration expressed by President Obama that mass shootings have become routine in America, prompting Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush to remark that stuff happens. Saul Cornell, the chair of American history at Fordham University and the author of The Second Amendment Goes to Court, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, The Slave State Origins of Modern Gun Rights, and the reasons for the paralysis in the gun safety debate that Obama wants to move away from a focus on gun rights to the rights of ordinary citizens not to be exposed to the recurring threat of mentally unstable people carrying out massacres with arsenals of weapons that are easily obtained because of lax and inadequate gun regulations. Then we'll look into the role of Iraq in helping Russia and Iran keep the Assad regime in power in Syria, while the U.S., after spending trillions and sacrificing thousands, still is supporting a government in Baghdad that defies U.S. foreign policy objectives while receiving billions in American aid. Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history and the author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, joins us to discuss the contradictions of fighting the Islamic State in Iraq and bombing them in Syria, which helps the Assad regime stay in power and contradicts our stated goal of getting rid of this murderous regime responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of its own people while reducing much of the country to rubble and causing a refugee crisis in Europe. Then finally, we'll examine the disastrous U.S. attack on the only hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, that is run by the French charity Médecins Sans Frontières, which resulted in 22 civilians killed, including MSF staff, patients, and children. Marvin Weinbaum, who served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan at the Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and is the author of The Future of Afghanistan, joins us to discuss this tragic case of collateral damage, compounding the already humiliating capture of Afghanistan's third largest city by the Taliban. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair of American History at Fordham University and author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And most recently, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He has an article at The Atlantic, The Slave State Origins of Modern Gun Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Well, thank you for having me again.
And just before we get into your article at The Atlantic, and also there's another article that you've co-written at the Yale Law Review, Firearm Regionalism and Public Carry, Placing Southern Antebellum Case Law in Context. Just to touch on the president's obviously extremely frustrated press conference following the massacre in the small town in Oregon, and then the subsequent press conference in the White House on the retirement of the Secretary of Education, where he elaborated much more in terms of his attitudes, both in terms of frustration and also basically putting forth the idea that at the end of the day, this is up to the American people to fix, and that even though polls indicate that the majority of the American people want to be protected from mentally unstable people having access to arsenals and being able to just go out and massacre people in this recurring way that has become routine, he suggested that the American people, the majority, have to organize and start voting just like the NRA people do. And that ultimately is the NRA's real ace in the hole, is that they get their people out to vote. So Do you accept that and agree with his strategy for what it's worth?
Well, I think we have a pretty good understanding of the dynamics of the gun debate in America. I wouldn't dismiss the fact that the gun rights community, which has a very loyal base but also gets a tremendous amount of money from the gun industry, outspends and outguns people in the peace industry. We don't have a kind of peace industry to donate to people who want to reduce gun violence in the same way that we do have a firearms industry, although you do have a few people like Michael Bloomberg who have tried to put some money into the cause. But I think Obama is essentially right. What political scientists have discerned is that in almost every instance in modern America, if you have a smaller group of really intensely committed people who will sort of single issue vote and who will organize and who will harass their representatives, they are able to achieve much more than a large group who has a kind of diffuse commitment to an issue. And so I think at one level it's a dysfunction of our contemporary system that until people make gun violence something close to the top of their concern list, we're never going to see a substantial change, certainly not at the federal level, although we have seen some improvements at the state level, although those have been balanced by those states that have actually relaxed their gun regulatory regimes. So, in a way, we almost have a kind of continental drift where one plate is moving in one direction and the other plate is moving in the other direction.
And, of course, the president did say that it's time for people who are concerned about gun safety and recurring massacres in this country to make gun safety a single issue and to become single-issue voters. But we should remind ourselves, surely, that after the Sandy Hook massacre, and I know that took place quite close to where you are, Saul Cornell, the vote was pretty overwhelming, and if it wasn't for this filibuster threshold in the Senate of 60 votes, there would have been some legislation that would have been carried after that hideous massacre of little kids in their classroom.
Well, that's correct. I mean, we did actually have a majority of the Senate vote for that background checks bill, but of course it required more than a simple majority, which is not what the Constitution mandates. Although it is also probably worth pointing out that had it gone to the House, it's quite probable it wouldn't have gotten a majority there. But I think that speaks to the issue that there are many people who do not voice their concern about this issue, and that leads politicians to cater to those who do. So you hear this all the time that congressmen or state representatives have their offices flooded with emails and texts and calls from gun rights people, and they simply don't get the same level of outrage from people who want to see some pretty basic common sense changes in our culture. And that difference in intensity continues to be one of the reasons why we don't see much progress.
It's fascinating to read your article and to learn how much this right to bear arms, almost obsession in the United States, has its origins in the South, and that going back to the antebellum South, Southern men carried weapons both as a protection against the slaves and also to be prepared for quarrels between free men, and that two of the most feared public carry weapons in pre-Civil War America were in the South, of course, were the Arkansas toothpick and the Bowie knife, which were forged from this Southern heritage. So explain your thesis that's both in the Atlantic article and in the Yale Law Review.
Well, essentially what those two articles, one is a scholarly article and one is an article aimed at a broader popular audience, it looks at two very interesting things. Why are the precedents that are being cited by people who want to push a very expansive and aggressive view of the right to carry firearms in public, why are all the precedents coming from the slave South? And should we take those precedents as representative of a broad consensus in America? And of course, what we found when my co-author and I looked into the history was that there's a whole regulatory tradition that was not litigated outside of the South. So you had laws on the books prohibiting traveling armed in populated places. Obviously, you could go to muster with your gun, and obviously you could hunt with your gun in regions that were open to hunting. But the idea that you just had an inherent right to pack whenever you wanted doesn't really represent the dominant tradition in America. In fact, the dominant tradition is a much more narrow one, that, you know, where there's a clear and imminent danger, there is a right to preemptively arm yourself, to defend yourself. But in most circumstances, the idea that we should just arm everyone and let them out in public is not what the right to have a gun and the right of self-defense meant for most of American history, except in the slave South, which has the most violent culture in pre-Civil War America. And the South actually passes the first laws against concealed weapons, and half the southern states approved, the courts approved those laws, and half the southern states strike them down as violations of the right to bear arms. Now, what's interesting, of course, is we ignore the half of the southern states that that upheld the laws, because Justice Scalia in District of Columbia v. Heller basically dismissed that part of the history because it didn't fit his ideology. So even in the South, there was some division, but outside of the South, there was a pretty clear political and cultural consensus that whatever the right to bear arms meant, it didn't mean that everyone got to pack heat whenever they wanted to.
Well, just quoting from your article, during the antebellum years, many viewed carrying a concealed weapon as dastardly and dishonorable, a striking contrast with the values of the modern gun rights movement. In a 1850 opinion, the Louisiana Supreme Court explained that carrying a concealed weapon gave men, quoting, secret advantages and led to unmanly assassinations, while open carry placed men upon an equality and incited men to a manly and noble defense of themselves. I have to say that strikes a real chord with me, because I've often thought, since I've come to this country and become an American, but having been born in Australia, where there's a totally different culture in terms of manliness, and nobody can argue that Australia is not a fairly chauvinistic country. But if anybody, if any manly man, were to pull a gun or a knife in a fight, he would immediately be looked upon as an abject coward. Whereas here in the United States, guns are used as an instrument to prove your manliness, and that is very much the case with this shooter in Oregon. He apparently, like all of these, have a very similar profile, and there's also this peculiar sort of sexual element too, that somehow a gun is a substitute for another organ, and that this fellow in Oregon was a 26-year-old virgin. The shooter in up at the college here nearby here in Santa Barbara also was a virgin, and I don't know, at the risk of getting into cheap psychiatrics, there seems to be a couple of strands there. One is that we have a culture that should be shaming people for having guns as opposed to celebrating them. And two, we have this problem with young men using guns as a substitute for being able to have a normal relationship with a woman.
Well, there's no question that attitudes towards guns in America track very closely with ideas about masculinity, and they always have. The vast majority of gun owners to this day are still men. It's also true that guns in American history have a fascinating history with race in America. One of the interesting things that people have been talking about recently is that many of the attitudes that get you elected to Congress today, probably if you were an African American, saying them in the 60s would have gotten you investigated by the FBI. That the kind of radical gun rights ideology of the Black Panthers, which was considered so dangerous in the 60s, has pretty much been embraced by the Tea Party and many gun rights groups. And it's sort of funny that when those ideas are articulated by Black men, they are considered to be deviant, but when articulated by white men, they're considered to be patriotic. I mean, some people have suggested that the next moment that we'll see a major turn in the gun control debate will somehow turn on Islamic use of guns, and the moment that we see more and more terrorist attacks committed with just simple, legally obtainable firearms, that maybe that will be the point at which we will see some real change in terms of the regulatory regime. We've already seen a little bit already, but the point at which California adopted more broad gun control was, of course, when the Black Panthers showed up on Ronald Reagan's doorstep with firearms, and suddenly Reagan, who had always been associated with a gun rights position, changed his mind.
Well, in the Al-Qaeda handbook that was captured in Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion, literally 14 years ago today, the Al-Qaeda advised those who wanted to attack the far enemy, meaning the United States, that they should not bring weapons into the United States. They are freely available. And that was a part of their advice. So it's not like that hasn't been happening for some time. And, of course, the shooter down that shot up the U.S. serviceman recently had obtained his weapons, of course, legally, and as had this fellow in Oregon, who got 14 weapons from federally licensed dealers, at least most of them.
Well, I think this definitely speaks to one of the things that's really hard to communicate to the public. But the fact is, there are certain changes in American society. Quite apart from the gun laws and quite apart from the firearms technology. But America was a tightly knit rural agrarian society at the time of the Second Amendment. We now live in a fairly anonymous urban society, and we've never actually been able to talk intelligently about how constitutional ideas change when you change everything about the society in which they're articulated. So we still have the Second Amendment, but we don't ever have a conversation about what it means to honor it given these other changes. I mean, there was no such thing as buying a weapon anonymously in the 18th century. You know, you needed to be in touch with your local gunsmith because those weapons needed a lot of work to keep them in good working order. And you wouldn't have been able to field the militia unless the states had the authority to muster you and inspect your weapon and fine you if you didn't keep your weapon in properly stored. So what I generally find is the more people mention the Second Amendment, the louder they mention it, the less they actually understand about the world that gave us the Second Amendment. And that's a big problem, that we don't honor the whole language of the amendment, and we don't understand the world that the amendment came from.
Well, I think in one of our previous conversations, Saul Cornell, you pointed out that one of the purposes of the Second Amendment to have well-regulated militias was that during the American Revolution, when George Washington's army handed out these largely French weapons to the American rebels, often they went off into the hills and took the guns home with them and never came back.
Well, I mean, getting the right kind of weapons in the hands of militiamen was, of course, a big part of what the Second Amendment was intended to accomplish, and people forget that it was a kind of a form of taxation. It was transferring the cost of public defense to individual households by making you get your own gun and make your own ammunition. So the Second Amendment is not part of some libertarian, anti-government ideology. It's really part of the 18th century's understanding of what it meant to be a republic, where citizens had obligations and responsibilities as well as rights. And, you know, if you think about the case of both the Newtown shooter and this most recent shooting, those individuals would have been part of a communal organization, the militia. They would have been part of a community that kept an eye on them and did not allow them to fester on their own and accumulate large numbers of weapons. They would have probably had the single musket they needed to meet the militia, unless they were fairly well-to-do, and people would have been keeping an eye on them. So the question is, since we don't have those kind of close-knit communities anymore, what can we do so that we don't see things like what happened in Newtown and what recently happened in Oregon? And I think it involves changes in laws, changes in cultures, changes in the way we think about our constitutional tradition, changes in the way we think about the role of guns in our society. But it will only happen when people think it matters. And basically, the cost of gun violence, except for these horrific mass shootings, are generally borne by populations that we don't hear as much about. It's urban populations, minority populations, or it's, you know, older Americans who are suffering from mental illness. And it's important to remember depression is a mental illness, and that gun suicides still outnumber gun homicides in America. And we have to start talking about a country where if you love someone and they're depressed, or you ask them questions like, have you locked up your guns, or maybe while you're depressed you should, you know, you should have those guns out of the house until you're feeling a bit better. I mean, that's not taking away anyone's Second Amendment rights, but that, I think, is what a caring society will do, because we know that the difference between attempting suicide with pills or knife or any other common method and using a gun is that guns are very effective at what they do. And you know, the lethality effect of guns is phenomenal. And if you try with a commit suicide with a gun, you're very likely to succeed.
Well, Saul Cornell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair of American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And most recently, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He also has an article at The Atlantic, The Slave State Origins of Modern Gun Rights. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the role of Iraq in helping Russia and Iran keep the Assad regime in power after the U.S. has spent trillions and sacrificed thousands, and they're still supporting the government in Baghdad.
There's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining me now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and the president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And obviously it's too much to ask in foreign policy to have some gratitude expressed. But nevertheless, the idea that Iraq is helping Russia and Iran keep the Assad regime in power and refusing U.S. entreaties to stop the overflights of Russian and Iranian aircraft that are basically keeping the Assad regime going after the U.S. has spent trillions and sacrificed thousands, the U.S. is nevertheless still supporting this government in Baghdad that's defying U.S. foreign policy while receiving billions in American aid. So are we, is Uncle Sam looking like Uncle Sucker here?
Well, Uncle Sam looks like somebody who has a split personality. Is the major threat in the Middle East today ISIL? Or is it al-Assad? You have to make a choice. You can't get rid of both. So the Iraqis are looking around and they think that ISIL is the big threat that they face. Assad's not doing anything to them at the moment. And so they've decided to make a tactical alliance with the Russians and al-Assad in hopes of having them take care of these hardline or even apocalyptic Sunni cults that are threatening Baghdad.
So the idea that I think it's pretty, it's not an idea, I think it's a fact, that Assad largely brought this situation on himself by refusing to acknowledge that his own people were demonstrating for basic human rights, and instead of coming up with some kind of political compromise, he decided to gun them down in the streets. That's, what, ancient history, irrelevant to the situation as far as Iraq's concerned?
Yeah, as far as Iraq is concerned, Iraq regularly saw al-Assad as a source of terrorism. They believed that he was deliberately letting these Salafi jihadi groups transit Syrian territory to get to Baghdad to blow things up And they talked very dirty about al-Assad from 2006 forward. But all of a sudden, in 2011, the then Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, swung around and began to see the instability in the region as the real threat and began exploring resumption of relations with Damascus. And, of course, as you say, the Syrian regime dealt with its own youth revolution by drawing up tanks and firing on civilian crowds, putting snipers on roofs and shooting into peaceful civilian assemblages and polarized the situation, more or less drove the Sunnis of Syria into the arms of al-Qaeda and ISIL.
Well, my understanding, Juan, is that just the other day before Russia, 1 hour before Russia started to bomb in Syria, a Russian military attaché showed up from the Russian embassy in Baghdad to the U.S. headquarters in the Green Zone and said we're about to bomb, giving them 1 hour notice. And is it possible that this Iran deal that the Obama administration and the P5+1 have concluded? There's been a lot of talk amongst U.S. Middle East specialists that the nuclear deal is what it's ostensibly about on paper, but what it's really about is Iran coming in from the coal and joining the rest of the world and then eventually becoming a trading partner and et cetera, and even becoming a country that might cooperate with the U.S., particularly in Afghanistan, et cetera. Is it possible that we've completely got it wrong, or those that believe that have got it wrong, that in fact, as soon as the deal is completed, it's becoming clearer and clearer that Russia, Iran, and Iraq are much freer to act in support of bolstering their ally Assad and to hell with us?
No, I don't see this as related to the nuclear deal. The nuclear deal is about the United States making multiple bets. You know, it has a Saudi bet and didn't have an Iranian bet. Now it has one. I think the evidence is that the Iranians have been supporting the al-Assad regime very dynamically for several years. And what's really happened is that in response to the Iranian support for the al-Assad regime and its effectiveness, because the Iranians intervened to stop the fall of Homs, which would have cut off Damascus in the north, they intervened on the Lebanese-Syrian border with Hezbollah. The Iranian riposte last year was quite effective. Then in response, the Saudis and the Gulf and Turkey created a new alliance on the ground among the hardline Salafi Sunnis called the Army of Conquest. And that coalition includes al-Qaeda, which is the most effective fighters amongst them. These are people who report directly to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, who was one of the masterminds of 9/11. There are fighters in the al-Qaeda group that had been with bin Laden in Afghanistan. So it's quite shameful, actually, that the Gulfi strategy is to, in a way, camouflage the coalition's dependence on al-Qaeda. So in the north, Idlib province west of Aleppo has fallen completely to the Army of Conquest. But what that means is that very large swathes of it are now the emirate, the al-Qaeda emirate. And they are making plans to move further west to the port city of Latakia, which is largely an Alawite Shiite area, a regime bastion. If that port fell, Then Damascus would be cut off from resupply and the regime would fall. So the Iranians appear to have gone to the Russians and said, look here, Mr. Putin, we can't stop this any longer. They gave the Army of Conquest and you know, the Al Qaeda and its allies were given TOW and tank killing weaponry by the Gulfies. Some of what the U.S. gave to its Free Syrian Army allies appears to have made its way to Al Qaeda. And the Iranians and the regime are helpless before it. So they said, unless the Russians intervene, then the regime is going to fall. Mr. Putin had a choice to make, to let basically an Al-Qaeda spearheaded coalition take Latakia or not. And he's decided to make a stand.
Well, indeed, the Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, Army of Conquest are right there in Damascus, in Dumia, and they mortared the other day the Russian embassy compound. So this is what's going on, and that Russia's basically trying to blunt the assault on the capture of Damascus and then Latakia.
Yes, well, the initial strategy appears to be to defend Latakia from the Al-Qaeda-led group in Idlib. That's why the Russians are making a military airport near Latakia. They're putting in about 1,000 Russian Marines to defend it, because obviously a resupply airport would be attacked by Al-Qaeda, and so it has to be defended. And they're putting in tanks and artillery to defend it. And then they're expanding their small naval facility that's been leased to them at Tartus, just near Latakia on the Mediterranean Sea, which hadn't been that consequential for Russia. It's often mentioned as one of the reasons Russia is involved in Syria, but the Russians don't stop there very often. It's not a very important, it's a small port. But they appear now to have decided to expand it and to turn it into a place from which they could offload military supplies. And so their initial strategy appears to be to strengthen the defenses of Latakia and then to engage in airstrikes against the Army of Conquest and its Al-Qaeda element, although they have also hit regime enemies that are small groups, local groups, some of them trained by the CIA and allied with the United States and Saudi Arabia in places like the area north of the city of Hama, which has elicited a great deal of protest from the United States. But I think the main targets appear to me to have been Army of Conquest targets, which is to say that the United States is protesting about Russia hitting Al-Qaeda and its allies.
Well, indeed, here we are getting bent out of shape over Russia going after Al-Qaeda. That certainly is a huge irony, particularly if you consider that Ayman al-Zawahiri is directing the operation, and he's the one of the main architects of the 9/11 attacks here on the United States. What's your sense then of what Obama said the other day in the White House in the press conference when he was saying goodbye to his Secretary of Education, that Putin's only got Iraq, he's only got Iran and Assad, and we've got the rest of the world, a huge coalition? What are we doing with this huge coalition?
Well, this is what I don't understand. I find Obama's Middle East policy towards Iraq and Syria to be riven with contradictions, and it's not clear what the president wants or what he's been doing. So, for instance, you know, he does these sorties against ISIL in Raqqa, out in the far eastern Syrian desert. A lot of those sorties don't actually involve dropping any bombs, and it's very clear that all of those expensive F-16 flights have amounted to nothing with regard to ISIL's actual capabilities. They took Palmyra, again, an eastern desert town, but their major asset now is northern Iraq, and the U.S. has done nothing, absolutely nothing, about ISIL. It talks a good game. Obama talks a good game against ISIL, but they've accomplished nothing, and the evidence is that it's just all propaganda. They've put a spin on it that we're rolling ISIL back, and there's been enormous pressure on professional security analysts in the CIA and elsewhere in the government to go along with this cover story that Obama is accomplishing something against ISIL. And then how does it work? And Obama has done nothing against al-Assad at all. So he says Assad should step down. He says that ISIL needs to be destroyed. But he's done nothing to accomplish either goal. And now he's complaining that Putin has come in and is bombing regime enemies that include al-Qaeda. And it seems, behind the scenes, that the U.S. has trained fairly large numbers, perhaps thousands, of Syrian rebel fighters. The Pentagon plan to create a new Free Syria army has crashed and burned and didn't amount to anything. But the CIA covert training appears to have been extensive, and that many of these CIA-trained fighters are now more or less allied with al-Qaeda. So I look out on this landscape. I don't see, villains and heroes. It's a very dark picture. And I also find Obama's position in it all to be extremely feckless.
Well, but there's something very real as well that's affecting Europe, and that is the refugee crisis. And I'm totally puzzled as to why not just the U.S., but the Europeans have dropped the ball, in the sense that, for example, the Turks were been shouldering most of this, and the Jordanians. $5 billion the Turks have spent on humanitarian aid, and eventually they sort of ran out of money, and then they allowed the people to leave the camps to cross the Aegean. Many drowned, of course, and we know what's happening. So I don't understand, how can you be feckless in the face of this kind of problem, whether you are Obama or all of the European leaders?
Well, I don't think, to be fair, there's much that Obama could have done about a refugee crisis.
And well, I'm referring to what you were saying earlier, in the sense
about,
that he, yeah, go ahead.
My complaint is about the unclear war goals, or the contradictory ones. I mean, he's allied with Iran in Iraq against ISIL, and the U.S. has actually flown close air support in support of hardline Shiite militias, which are on Iran's side, if not, in fact, Revolutionary Guards corpsmen, and a few engagements at Tikrit and elsewhere in Iraq. And in Syria, where the Iranians on al-Assad's side, the U.S. seems to at least talk as though it's on Saudi Arabia's side, on the opposite side in Syria. So the policy is a complete mess, is completely inconsistent. And, of course, this long and brutal fighting on the ground, especially in Syria, has killed over 200,000 people and has left half the country. It was a country of 22 million. 11 million are now homeless, of which 4 million are homeless abroad. They've fled the country. And Obama's response to the refugee crisis has been to spend money on it. And actually, he has been more generous than anybody but Kuwait towards the refugees. The U.S. has really stepped up for refugee aid to Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey in that regard. But what I'm saying is that the longer this war goes on, the more destruction there will be, and the more Syria will be emptied out. And I don't see Obama's policies in Syria as ending the war. I mean, he can't defeat ISIL and also destroy the Damascus regime at the same time. If he destroys the Damascus regime first, then ISIL will sweep into Damascus. And that's not going to be a good scene to have ISIL in control of Syria. And it will empty out more, because who would want to live under such a government? But if he defeats ISIL first, then inevitably that will strengthen the Syrian regime. So I don't think he has his priorities straight. I frankly cannot understand what he thinks he's doing over there.
So there's nothing that we're missing then here. Is there some hidden agenda? You know, when mentioning earlier the analysts being sort of encouraged to suck it up while the superiors massage the assessments?
Well, this is my dark suspicion, which is that let's say you were Obama and you just didn't want anything to do with the Middle East, and you think that the real breakthroughs you can make in foreign policy are a trade deal with South Korea and standing up to China and the Philippines and that kind of thing. That's where your real efforts are. And then ISIL emerges and Al-Assad kills the demonstrators. So you develop a rhetoric, Assad should step down and ISIL should be rolled back. But then, you know, every time you have a press conference, reporters are going to ask, what are you doing about these things? And so you can say, well, we flew 25 sorties against ISIL last week. But, you know, it doesn't amount to anything. It's just a way of deflecting the question. So I don't think there is a policy here. And to the extent that it is one, I think it's probably mainly being driven by local actors. So Obama has to have good relations with King Salman in Saudi Arabia. And he is, you know, providing logistical support to the Saudi horrible bombing campaign in Yemen. And then the Saudis have this plan to, you know, have this cover story about something called the Army of Conquest, which is allowing Syrian Salafis to cooperate with al-Qaeda. And behind the scenes, Obama is just going along with that. So I think that the policies are being driven by the fact that Obama is not interested, doesn't have a foreign policy of his own, and is constrained by his alliances with Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And he's kind of letting them have their head, especially since they didn't want him to do the Iran deal, and he has done it. And so this is maybe a booby prize to let them have Syria. I don't know. But what I can say is that there's no consistency here.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog informcomment@juancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the disastrous U.S. attack on the only hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, that was run by the French charity Médecins Sans Frontières.
چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنین نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی بچند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and scholar-in-residence at the Middle East Institute. From 1999 to 2003, he served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan for the United States Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and he's the author of The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Hello.
So this terrible collateral damage involving the killing of 22 civilians, including Médecins Sans Frontières staff, patients and children at the only hospital in the northern city of Kunduz that was recently captured by the Taliban, seems to be collateral damage that's also compounding the already humiliating capture of Afghanistan's third largest city by the Taliban. So pretty bleak, isn't it, in terms of looking forward at the future of Afghanistan? which of
course... Yes, and it's bleak also because of what's going on in the region generally. I mean, the region of Afghanistan or around Kunduz. Several districts have fallen in neighboring provinces, so that the situation is broader than just the attack on Kunduz itself. There's been a deterioration, really, of security over a much wider area in the north.
So what is this? How do you frame this? Is this a case of it's easier to destroy than to build? That seems to be the unfortunate story of our 14-year intervention. That you know, so much of Kunduz was one of the successful. The Germans were operating up there with these civilian reconstruction teams, and they seem to have done a lot in terms of hospitals, sewage, septic. They've improved the lives of people, but obviously, this is all going to get rolled back.
Well, look, if we're going to look for why this has happened, I think we have to look what's gone on in Kabul. The government really has lost the confidence. And just this last year, if you go back exactly 1 year from now, when Ashraf Ghani came in to office, there was a great deal of hope here that a number of issues were going to be settled. For one thing, that there was going to be someone smart directing the government here, and that the deficiencies here in governance were going to be addressed. Certainly, corruption was going to be addressed. Ghani held out great hope here for a peace agreement that, together with Pakistan, they were going to be able to sit down with the Taliban and make a success of negotiations. And then, of course, the Afghan National Army had been given greater responsibility. And the hope was here that they would be able to stand up. Well, you know, here's a country that doesn't even have a defense minister in this time of great peril, that over this year, the unity government has not been able to agree on a defense minister. And so most of the comments that you see here are being made by the interior minister. While there is an acting defense minister, and this is a man who was rejected by the parliament for not being up to the job. So it gives you an idea at the central level of how the government has fallen down. But then at the local level, the absence here of good governance, a governor who was roundly disliked in the area, and a military force which, as in elsewhere in the country, has shown a lack of really good leadership. And that's really why it's fallen the Kunduz and other areas too, because of a lack of leadership at the ground level here, and lack, as we're seeing here as well, as they try to recapture the city, of coordination among the military forces.
So is that to say that after the kind of Karzai mafia that the U.S. supported for so long, and clearly a lot of money left the country, and they've all got their palaces in the Gulf, etc., not to mention what they call the poppy palaces in Kabul itself. Is that to say that there just isn't a political culture that you can tap into there? That's, you know, I mean, Ghani comes, he had a lot of, he was overseas for a long time, I think, working with the World Bank, wasn't he? Is there any talent there or any capability there that you could actually use, or is this just the best that can be found?
Well, I think there is a good deal of human capital in the country. There are people in the country, some who came back, others who, because after all, it's 14 years since 2001, and a lot of young people, better educated people, have come in. So there is talent to work with, but and well, let's give Ghani some credit. He's tried to manage this. He's tried to put it on a more rational basis. Karzai operated almost exclusively using the patronage system. Ghani has tried to modernize this, and let's not forget the uphill climb here that they're going to have to make here with this transition that's been going on, where on the security side, our forces went from 100,000 to under 10,000, where we, by leaving as we did, so much of what was holding up that economy just simply disappeared. And then you have what's been going on for so long here, the fact that although we got them to agree in forming a unity government, it really hasn't operated very much like a unity government. They're still unable to agree on a great many issues, and constitutional questions that should have been addressed here have not. They've had to skip a parliamentary election because nothing, the mechanics were just not there for it. So it's been a real challenge. I think we can't underestimate that. But it's a government which, just whatever it is, has lost the confidence here of so many people. There are many leaving now, and that's an issue there itself. Before we've seen money leave, now we're seeing bodies leave.
I spoke the other day, Marvin, with Thomas Barfield, an anthropologist who spent decades and decades in Afghanistan.
Yes, very fine.
And he was lamenting the role of Pakistan all along, basically being the spoiler here, and the U.S. dependence upon this spoiler has resulted in large part with why we're in such a mess. And he pointed out that of all the neighbors of Afghanistan, whether that's Russia, China, and Iran, and of course the U.S. and NATO involved in Afghanistan, the only country that doesn't want a stable Afghanistan is Pakistan, or at least the Pakistan military and the ISI. Is that...
I don't totally subscribe to that. Although I have enormous regard for Tom Barfield. His view is certainly the view that so many Afghans have. They see all of their problems as somehow being traced. They can trace it to Pakistan and being perfidious in its foreign policy here. There's no question but that the ability of the Taliban to have sanctuary has kept this going as long as it has. But I think that the problem here has evolved. Back, 10 years ago or so, the insurgency probably couldn't have survived without Pakistan and having safe haven there. But what has happened in recent years is that the insurgency has establish roots within the country. We're seeing that now in what's happening in the north, and as well as in the south and east. We're seeing that these years of inability here to really grapple with the problems of the country, particularly the justice system here, and the quality of the governors and the district governors and so on, that the Taliban has been able now to establish itself so that it doesn't really need Pakistan the way it did. It can live off the land, smuggling poppies and various other legal and illegal sources of income. So that, to lay it all on Pakistan without absolving Pakistan of some of the responsibility, I think, is wrong. Let me add, though, that I believe and have written to some extent on this now, that the view in Pakistan actually changed about 2 years ago when they realized, along with everybody else, that a Taliban victory, an outright Taliban victory, would be bad news. Because unlike the 1990s when they supported the Taliban, clearly supported them, there was no insurgency going on in Pakistan. Well, Pakistan has its own insurgency, its own Taliban. And now they have to view their policy in Afghanistan in terms of what would be the impact on their own problem with militant extremists. And viewed that way, they cannot really deny the fact that a stable Afghanistan would be in their interest if it could be assured that it wouldn't be simply a tool of the Indians, because it's the Indians the Pakistanis worry about. Well, when Ashraf Ghani came in, he gave them just that, or at least he tried to. He said, in effect, look, let's reset our relationship here. I'm prepared here to work together with you. He said, without saying it, that I don't need the Indians as much if we have a good relationship. Well, actually, within the military as well as the civilian leadership, they bought into that. The problem is that they bought into that at the same time that they didn't relinquish their hedging strategy in Afghanistan. So they really were been running two policies towards Afghanistan. One in which they wanted to see this government succeed, a Ghani government, and at the same time, when they were unwilling to relinquish their patronage of the Afghan Taliban because of the fear that if things fall apart in Afghanistan, and indeed they may, they're going to need these friendly Pashtuns to go in there and secure the country so that they have at least large parts of the country in their sphere of influence as the rest of the country falls apart.
Yeah, but you can't hedge, can you, surely? If you, by supporting the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistanis are actually weakening the Ghani government.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a two-pronged policy which contradicts itself.
Right.
And that's exactly where things have been. They've wanted to have it both ways. And in doing that, I think neither of them really can be served. Neither strategy can be served.
But at this point, judging by what's happening with these attacks all around the country, and particularly in the north, it doesn't look good for the survival of the Ghani government.
I think it's, you know, let's not write it off right away. I had some optimism here that if the Ghani government could create a stable situation so that it could fend off the Taliban, make sure that in the next 2, 3 years, 4 years, they did not really gain very much on the security front, and if they could patch together their unity government and rebuild the economy with the international help, that time would then be on the side of the Ghani government, on the Kabul government. But that remains their only way of succeeding here. And I think the odds now grow increasingly lower, but just the same, that still remains as a possibility.
Okay.
So I'll put it this way. If we write them off now, then it's self-fulfilling. We know they will fail.
Well, Marvin Weinbaum, I thank you very much for joining us.
Surely.
And again, I've been speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois. He served as an analyst on the Pakistan-Afghanistan for the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and is the author of The Future of Afghanistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.